Welcome to the podcast Mujeres Fronterizas. My name is Cristian Aguilar, and thank you for joining us today in this new installment in the series for the Sky Island Alliance featuring women in conservation in the borderlands. For today's episode, I am joined by Francesca Clavery. Francesca is originally from Calexico, California, where her family has strong roots on both sides of the US-Mexico border. In 2013, she moved to Patagonia, Arizona, to intern with Native Seeds Search, and from there started the nursery now known as Borderlands Nursery and Seed for the nonprofit organization Borderlands Restoration Network, where she serves as the Native Plant Program Director. Hola, Francesca. Thank you so much for joining me on this edition of the podcast Mujeres Fronterizas. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Cristian. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Where are you right now?
Right now, I am at my house in Patagonia, Arizona, and I was working today out at the nursery. It's humid and beautiful. It's been raining. Thank goodness. And I came back to my house to do this in my room. So no one else can see this, but I'm in front of some of my favorite artwork, a little bit of plant art, but it's the quietest space in the house. It works.
Great. Yeah, I hear that you guys are getting a lot of rain and nothing here in Tucson. Well, a little bit. It can be worse, but I am envying you right now.
I know, we're so lucky. We hope it keeps up.
If you don't mind, can we start seeing from the very, very beginning when you were born?
So I'm originally from Calexico, California, and it's a really cool border town in the southeast corner of California. It's about an hour west of Yuma, and it shares a sister city with Mexicali, Baja California. And it's a really cool town. It's like maybe twice the size of Nogales, Arizona. So it's a bustling border town, kind of like classic downtown area. The wall has been up for most of my childhood and has always kind of grown there. But I had a really great experience growing up in that community, partly because my family, both sides of my family, have both been in Calexico for a very long time, since the my dad's family since the late 1800s, and my mom's family from the beginning of the 1900s. And my dad's family has roots in agriculture. They came to farm in the desert, pre-air conditioning, which is always wild to think about that as we live in these hot desert places, how people did things without air conditioning. And then my mom's family were Mexican, like politician, like military type families that had come out to Baja California in the early days of colonization there, with when Mexicali was becoming a city. For my mom, it was really important because my dad doesn't speak very much Spanish. She really wanted my brother and I to understand the importance of living on the border and the cultural aspects of learning Spanish and understanding the Mexican side too, because Mexicali is a huge city, upwards of 1 million people. And that's where you go to the good bars, and that's where you go to the nice restaurants, and there's an art, you know, they have art scenes, and it's a really cool city. It's the capital of Baja California Norte, actually. And so when we were little, she wanted us to go to school in Mexicali for primaria, for primary school. And so every day we got to walk across the border. And that was a huge part of my childhood and became a really huge part of my identity, of just from a very young age, having to wrap your mind around this line that humans drew in the ground that we then turn into a wall or a fence, or but the immediacy of every day kind of experiencing, looking at the peso to dollar ratio to see like what money, you know, oh, how much more the dollar is worth. And then it kind of ends up feeling like it tracks into like the value of human life and these weird borders that we put together. I had friends that I could visit in Mexicali, but they couldn't visit me. And when you're a little kid, that kind of stuff, it doesn't make sense. It's not logical. And I think it's important when you're young, it's easy to internalize those things of like the rules of this is how life and the society that we made is. But I remember just asking from a very young age all these types of questions of like, why can't Vanessa visit me? Like, why do I have to go over there? And it's like you get used to it, but as little kids, like everyone recognizes the disparity of those types of things and how when you're living on the same land in the same environment, it shouldn't be divided in that way. And as humans, we've put a lot of energy into these political systems that make it that way. From a very young age, it was fascinating growing up there and thinking about those things and coming to terms with border life. But I have such fondness for Calexico. My whole family is still there. My parents, my brother and his whole family, they're all in Calexico. And yeah, it's a really great community.
So interesting. What you mentioned, and like since you were a little kid, you start noticing these differences in between the borders and the political stuff that maybe you didn't realize at that time. This is political, but it's like how a wall influences everything in our lives. And I think I told you one time I was born in Mexicali.
Yeah.
I am Cachanilla, but I never got to experience that type of thing because when I was a baby, my dad ha found a job in Baja California Sur in La Paz, and so we moved over there, and I grew up in that part of the world of the peninsula. But I remember like going every vacation, every Christmas. It was for sure. We had to be there with my grandma, which my grandma and my aunts and uncles and cousins are still in Mexicali. And like, it was sad, so sad for me to see that everybody could cross the border and I didn't have the visa. And I had to be by myself with other cousins that didn't also have the permits to cross. And everybody spent a nice time in Calexico shopping, and they will come back, and I will be like, "What did you do? What did you see?" And it was like a mystery for me to what is in the other side of the wall. As a child, it was something super strange.
For everyone, especially children, to just feel so lesser when you're not allowed as a person that's trying to just live your life. And then, I mean, it is funny to me because Calexico is like not a fancy city. It's like a really it's not fancy. I feel like for Americans going to Mexicali, it's more like, oh, look at this city with more infrastructure. But because we can cross, like any American can cross, and as Mexicans without a visa, people can't cross, there's immediately that feeling of a massive barrier that you're not allowed be for some reason of you and who you are and your human papers that society has given you. It's not good enough. You are not good enough to come over. It's such a psychological detriment to people, and we just take it for granted now where you're like, oh. And even the crossing, like that's something that always has amazed me. Like in my lifetime, like I'm not very old, I'm 37 years old. And now needing sentry just to not be in line for like hours and hours and hours, and how important for people that are crossing all the time, like getting their sentry or reapplying, or oh, you accidentally brought meat that you forgot about, so they take it away and then you have to reapply. But like when we were little, we could cross every day. No one had sentry. Sometimes it would take a long time, but they would staff the border and move people through. And I recently got sentry, and like I remember a couple of years ago, it was like I was in line in Nogales in the middle of the night for like 4 hours just because they decided to open one crossing guard was there. And those types of things that as it becomes stricter and stricter, in a short amount of time, we still just take it for granted, like, oh, okay, they changed the rules a little bit. Oh, okay. But it's a real shame when it it limits, an entire part of your community when you're close to the border regions.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for my sentry. It's been a while since I applied for that thing. But yeah, it sucks. We have been also like in the line in Mexicali is always at least 4 hours to
Yep.
cross. And that's something that it takes me, like, it makes me think twice. Do I want to go and visit my family? Because I will spend probably a day thinking or like waiting in line or like, preparing for coming back.
Yeah, and if it's hot, I mean, if your car breaks down, like, oh my God, if you're in the line and don't have AC, that's 4 hours in like 120 degree weather that is just really difficult. Because that's another thing about that part of the border. It's very hot. It's a very, very hot area. And that's like what you had mentioned with the pura cachanilla, 100% pura cachanilla. It's like the people of Mexicali identify to this day. There's like Facebook groups called like the Cachanilla Facebook group and for Mexicali locals. And cachanilla is arrowweed, which is a really incredible native plant that kind of thrives on the drain ditches and along the canal waterways on both sides of the border. But I do really love that, where it's a tough plant. It gets very, very hot in Calexico and Mexicali. The hottest I'd ever experienced there was like the mid 120s, always in like the 115. Like it's hot there. And Patagonia is very nice and cool. It'll get hot in the summer, but even if it's like 104 in Patagonia, and my parents call and they're like, "What's the weather?" I'm always like, "Oh, it's very nice." And they're like, "Is it like 100?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's like 104." And they're like, "Oh, that's so nice." "Oh, very nice." And that's something else that like people are used to it and are careful with how they go out. And when you work outside, you have to be extra careful. And people start their days very, very early when you're working outside. Because running around doing errands in the afternoons is rough.
Yeah, it's time to look for solutions, or how do we adapt to a better way of being? Like, this heat that we have been having is killing people. It's not something to be proud of, or yeah. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, but this is for another podcast. Okay, Francesca, can you walk me through your career journey? From your first job you had to where you are now.
Yeah. So I grew up on a farm in Calexico, and in the early days I'd always get paid to like take care of animals or clean horse stalls. We lived just outside. We lived a few miles out of town, really close to what is now the East Port of Entry, Calexico East, which I think they built in the early 2000s, like 1999 or something, like late 90s, early 2000s. So it's like you can see the border, and it's all alfalfa fields. And so growing up, I did a lot of agriculture stuff. I always had, I don't know, random work, but I always wanted to be near horses, and so I'd get jobs like cleaning the horse stalls, cleaning up all the horse poop, and I loved it so much. And it's like outside work, but you like move hay bales around, that kind of thing. And then when I went to college, I really wanted to get out of Calexico and was like, I could stay close. I could maybe go to San Diego. But the University of California school system is really great in California. And I went to UC Davis because UC Davis has these really great plant and agriculture programs. And initially, I wanted to study international agricultural development. I was really excited about learning more about international cross-border trade type work and how poverty works and how food systems work. I was always fascinated by that. And then very quickly in the program realized things were not good and the model of development we still had and we're still imposing and talking about was kind of this idea that you have to keep colonizing to grow the economy. And even the advice to quote unquote countries that are developing and aren't as wealthy, it was kind of like, well, if you acquire more from other countries and you take it on and invest in it, and it just wasn't sustainable. And the Vandana Shiva quote that's really famous is like, there aren't any more continents to colonize. This metric that we use is just really unhealthy. And so I kind of was looking to still stay with plants and maybe agriculture, but study something different. And while in college, I got a job at the UC Davis Arboretum my freshman year. And I was like, oh, I know how to work with plants. I like grew up on a farm. I did Future Farmers of America, the FFA program. I know how to water things. And from there, got really into it. It was probably the most important thing, both academically and professionally for me, was taking a job at a nursery that specialized in native plant propagation. And I instantly became really into it. Just was so happy to be the tech, and every weekend would be watering the plants and potting up stuff and sowing seeds and scarifying seeds and just getting all these little plants to grow, figuring out where they were from in the world. We had our US desert collections, but we also worked with seeds from Australia, and it was so fun and so healthy to get to really get excited about the plants. And so I ended up doing through that, my major ended up being a combination because I took a lot of plant classes and like ethnobotany classes. Because something else I was always fascinated by was like kind of what we were talking about earlier. Why are people living in Calexico and Mexicali when it's so hot? Who was living here before air conditionings and before, white people came in and my people came in to colonize the region? Like who was surviving and thriving here? And what were they doing with the plants, like the arrowweeds? What was their connection to them? And so I took a few Native American language classes as a way to understand plant names and language families of like why people call plants certain things. And UC Davis has a wonderful Native American Studies department, and they just needed people in the department because to like up their numbers. And they were like, if you want to major in this, please, like, you only have a few more classes. And so I ended up doing Native American Studies with a minor in International Ag Development and got a lot of plant classes in and got these really important historical, cultural classes that just helped me think about how to be more responsible and understanding in the world. Just kind of a way to be like, oh, these are important ways to think about things. It's not like there's a bunch of answers. Everyone's always figuring things out. But to have a lot of respect for Indigenous people all over the world, and especially the history of Native Americans in our own country and in Latin America, that we border, like those are important stories to keep telling, and just important to be very respectful of that history. Because it is important and it's very overlooked. We don't tell those stories. So I'd been at the UC Davis Arboretum. When I graduated with those degrees, I wanted to keep working with plants, but they didn't have space for me. I was a student. And so I went back to Calexico and I started working for UC Davis Extension as a nematode scientist and got to work with nematodes, which are these incredible microscopic creatures that have their own phylum. There's nematodes everywhere. Like there's water nematodes. Most parasites are nematodes that like live in our bodies. And I specialized in the soil nematodes and was doing work. It was funded through like ag producers. Mostly, if you don't rotate carrots enough, if you just grow carrots in the same place year after year after year, it builds up with nematodes. And it doesn't even really hurt the carrots, but they look ugly. They don't have just the one taproot. They have like multiple taproots. So I did that for a bit, got into nematodes, even thought about studying nematodes. And then the UC Davis Arboretum called me and they said, we had a manager leave. We'd love for you to come back. And so I went back to Davis for a few more years and got to manage at the Arboretum. Loved working with the interns, just loved working with the programs and growing so many more plants and the plant sales and the volunteers. And I just realized after a few years, I was going to stay in Davis forever. And I love Davis. It's a great community, but I did really want to be back by the border. And I had always followed Native Seed Search since I was a kid. My mom subscribed to their newsletters, and I was always fascinated by the crops that people were growing and just what was adapted to different regions and food wise. And so I thought, oh, I'll take a little break. I'll leave work and I'll take a couple months off before I move down, maybe San Diego, maybe Calexico, maybe I'll open a nursery. I had all these ideas. But I came to Patagonia with Native Seed Search and got to live in this trailer. They hooked me up in a trailer. They didn't pay anything, but they fed us and we got to work at the Native Seed Search farm and grow corn and hand pollinate corn and keep these accessions, like, separated and just try and care for the plants. And while I was down here, I ran into the folks that had just started Borderlands Restoration. And it was like Ron Pulliam and some of these retired academics that were really excited about these projects of restoring wildlands. And it was early 2013, 2013, and they had just started up the year before. And they wanted to have a nursery. They were interested for this one project they had. They needed to grow out a bunch of hummingbird plants. And so I like went for it and was like, oh, I can do that. That's no problem. We can do it. And then we quickly realized, like, oh, there's a lot of interest in this. There's a need to produce more plant materials. And no one in the Patagonia region had really worked with like a lot of the species that were being wild collected around there. And making them available for restoration. So we started working with the Forest Service a lot and slowly just applied for a lot of grants and got different contracts. And now the program has grown where we have an entire seed component that's basically its own program that's run by Perrin McNeilis, who does an amazing job. We have our nursery component. We're getting into more re-veg work. We have a hydro seeding component and we have the farm. We just purchased the Native Seed Search farm. And are slowly expanding it to grow more and more and more native perennial plants for seed. Because making seed accessible is so important. And oftentimes you can't find locally sourced seed at all, or especially seed that was ethically harvested, where you're not taking all the seed that's there, but we're able to use wild genetics and then replicate them to grow them out in the farm. And those plots don't require very much water once they're established because they're perennial. You don't have to plant them every year. And we've now developed, a really great program. And it's all just like been, I think a lot of it has just been very lucky. And we have really good people that have come in and that have been really passionate about the work to keep it going. It's a lot of work, but it's really rewarding work too.
Wow. All that. You have been doing a lot of things, Francesca. So cool. So, do you think that living in a border town influenced you in your current position?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, that definitely drew me to Patagonia was I think Patagonia is technically like 7 or 8 miles from the wall. It's not direct, like you have to go. It's like 20 minutes driving to get around. And if you go the more direct way, it's a lot of dirt roads. I feel very at home in a border region. And it means a lot to me, especially even just growing up and learning Spanish from a young age and using the bilingualism. I really like that about border areas, and especially when it comes to plants and communicating around plants. The more accessible we can make just access to plants or even caring about plants or wanting to learn about plants or appreciating them, just maybe you just think they're pretty, like that's okay too. But that coupled with being on the border, I think is huge. And it's something I've always felt very drawn to. I feel very privileged that I was able to grow up and go to school in Mexicali. That was, I think, I feel very, very lucky that my mom made that happen because a lot of people can't do that. And it sounds really great, but it's a lot of work going back and forth all the time. But I think it's been really, really helpful. And for me, it's made me really want to communicate and figure out how to support and give advice and talk about the mistakes that we've made to other people trying to get into this work, but just be encouraging. And I think with everything going on in the world, whenever we can make those jumps while being in these border areas, it's even more important because so often there's a lot of communication that gets cut off. There isn't as much a radius when you're close to the border. It's like you just shave off half of that circle, kind of. And people aren't, yeah, there isn't a lot of access. So for me, that was an important thing to do early on, was how to connect with our neighbors in Mexico or just in Nogales, Arizona, who needed Spanish language classes and were interested in having accessibility. But yeah, I think I would, I mean, I definitely wouldn't be here if I didn't grow up on the border. I don't know if I would have found myself here. But I'm very happy I did.
Does your position you have now with the Borderlands Restoration Network, do you guys have like opportunities to go to Mexico and do your job?
Our big one is mostly the Sonoran Field School. So that's when we have the most opportunity to go over and give classes in Spanish. But then we also have like a good partnership with Cuenca Los Ojos. So we have a larger partnership through the Agave work with Bat Conservation International. And they've been excellent partners for like going across the border. I often feel though, like we'll go over and do some of the trainings, but we were also careful to not try and like co-opt that, but how you send capacity funding when people need it. And like honestly, with COVID, it was very helpful to get everyone more excited about virtual connections. And Christian, who's interviewing me right now, you have been very instrumental in helping us with our virtual bilingual native plant propagation class. And we've done one through Watershed Management Group. We've done a handful through Borderlands, and they're always very popular. People sign up from all over Mexico and all over the United States. And I think that's always a nice opportunity to get people in the same virtual room when sometimes the travel can be really tricky. I love to travel, you know, whenever I can to do programming in Mexico. It just has to, we just really have to plan it because we are always kind of short-staffed, and with plants, you can't just leave them. You have to like be there every day, and if you're not, you have to really have good people who will, and you know, you have to have a series of complicated backup systems. So if someone can't go in, they know who to call, and you can't ever really be, you have to just plan really well for it. So I wish we could do that more, but I'm also happy that we're place-based and have enough flexibility to travel when we need to support native plant programs elsewhere. We're also always happy to have visitors if people are able to cross. And then we're also always happy to get on a Zoom and do our classes.
So, is there something in particular, Francesca, that inspired you to study and work in things related to the environment?
I got excited about learning about the environment, both from being in Calexico and having it be a very, very hot place. And then also my family are alfalfa farmers, which is a very high input, very high water input system. The Imperial Valley grows a lot of alfalfa, like enough for it to supply a very large portion of our domestic use, and then they also export it all over the world. And I was always fascinated by how that even happened. And I've always been fascinated about the ways that it's also very unsustainable and is probably not going to happen forever, and maybe even in the shorter term, not happen anymore. So I think originally I was just very curious about the practicality aspects of studying and doing environmental work. Like, I've always been obsessed with the apocalypse, like those types of things where you're always like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And in the scheme of things, this section of our timeline, even of the last few thousand years, isn't very long. And there's been so many changes, and how can we recover? But then, through plants specifically and native plant work, there also just is a whole other level of passion and beauty and fascination and complexity that I've learned so much from amazing plant nerds and have been so inspired by people that are so good at growing plants or IDing plants. And in so many ways, like I'm not like an amazing botanist. I know the plants that we grow and we're always learning new plants, but I have the opportunity to work with really good plant nerds. And so I think trying to take the good things and the positive and putting good energy into things when so many people in our generation feel really hopeless by the state of the world. And the more that you learn, the scarier it kind of gets. And so having a really good energy sink that is still challenging and no one's figured it out and everyone's working really hard to do a better and better job, but putting that, yeah, that positive energy in around plants, because plants don't care about our politics. They don't care about what humans are up to. They're just trying to figure it out and keep producing seed and keep growing. And a vast majority of the biodiversity on Earth is held together by plants living in the soil. Like it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, we need plants and plants don't need us, I
Yep.
guess. Can you share with us some of the challenges you have faced along your professional route or way?
Yeah, I wish I had like a better or trickier answer, but a big part of my professional development has been learning a lot of the administrative aspects of keeping an organization afloat. I was very lucky to be able to start at the founding edge of a program where I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right background. I wasn't good enough or experienced enough to be looking for a really competitive job doing what I was doing. I just kind of stumbled into it and I happened to be here and found a place to rent. And so just started doing it and I've learned a lot along the way. Something I always tell my mom is like, if I applied for my job now, or if I had been at Davis and tried to apply for the job now, there's no way that would have happened. So that part was very lucky. But the fact that we haven't gone under in the 11 years I've been in Patagonia, just because so many young nonprofits don't make it, and you have to get through these big humps and hurdles. And there's always like, I mean, so many challenges that come with all of a sudden there's no money or the grant has not been reimbursed and you can't make payroll. There's so many tricky things that come with trying to do this as a living professionally. And getting people paid and trying to pay people enough. There's so many mental health issues with those of us that work in the nonprofit sector because people are always giving so much of themselves to a job that ultimately you need to be paid for and be paid well for. The nonprofit industry will like kind of take advantage of that sometimes. I feel like we've done a good job of trying to like give the best pay increases that we can and be competitive. But looking at the larger budgets, it's always very stressful. And hoping that enough work comes in, enough grants, that you sell enough plants, but that you're also diversified. And that's something I think we've done a very good job of recently to overcome is like, we haven't just decided to like, we're just going to have a nursery and that will work out. And, you know, we're in Patagonia, it's a town of 900 people. Like, we travel places to sell plants, but you really need to diversify that because, like, if the creek is running during our monsoon plant sale and we don't get that day of sales, if that's all we did, that could be horrible. And so, making sure we do a lot of different things and do a combination of grants, of contracts, has been really good for us in feeling like this is going to work. And so, for me, I mean, constantly, my big stressors with my job are that we have to bring in the whole budget every year. Perrin and I, as the manager and director of the program, come up with like, okay, what are our projects going to be? Let's apply for a bunch of stuff, and you only get like half of them. And hopefully, you get enough so that you don't have to let anyone go. And so far, we've been really lucky. And we're still kind of new enough where we don't have a super large donation base. So it's always like you follow where the work is and where the projects are. We're very, very on the groundwork project based, which is really cool. But there's like a whole element of stress with that, of like, are we going to be able to keep everyone paid? You know, that's always a big one. But so far, so good. And even just recently, in the last few years, I feel like we're doing well and we're getting better at planning, and you have to think multiple years out. But that was a very steep learning curve when you have like someone that was into watering plants and like had written some papers, like, but just not a business person. But you have to figure, yeah, you got to figure it all out.
Yeah, money. That's the thing. But yeah, you're doing great, Francesca. Can you tell us how do you stay motivated and focus on your professional goals?
I really think of it long term. Like, for me, I'm very committed to Borderlands, partly because I also live in Patagonia and I don't want to live anywhere else, and there aren't that many job opportunities. I always joke because I spend a lot of time at the Wagon Wheel Bar, and I always joke with them where I'm like, all right, if I lose my job or it doesn't work out, I'm going to like quickly learn to bartend. So, like, hold me over. And they're always like, yeah, you're not a good enough bartender. But I'm always like, ooh, what could I do? But ultimately, like, for me, the motivation comes from trying to keep everything afloat. And we have a very good community of people. I'm constantly really inspired by the people that I work with. It's not easy. Like, everyone romanticizes community a lot, and romanticizes like, oh, everyone's working and living together and you're in this small town. There's so much drama that comes with that, just because you're like always up in everyone's business. And so, kind of growing up with people and learning when to let things go and when to communicate what's hard and having like really hard conversations, that's a lot of work. And so many times the whole project's almost failed because of those things that are just so rough on people. But I'm constantly motivated by, yeah, the really awesome community, down to like people that come to visit for a bit and are going, doing something else that's similar in a different part of the world. That to me is really motivating. And so, yeah, I'm sure I still have like a very big founder syndrome, but I am just like, for my professional goals, I'm really focused on seeing this project work out and get to a point where it can be healthy and sustainable financially and do its own thing. It's always different, it's always changing and it's always different. And communication around what the rains are doing, like right now is summer is my favorite time of year. And this summer has been particularly beautiful. And even in the really hot season, because everyone's freaking out about when the rains are going to come. So it's all anyone talks about. And being like a little quiet about it on social media because it's been so good for June. And then all the old timers get stressed and they're like, maybe it just won't rain anymore. Maybe that's it. It's like no one knows. For the farm to do well, for the nursery plants to do well, we depend a lot on rain. So even that part of it, I think is really helpful because you're connected not just in all the human elements of learning financial management, but like you have to connect it to the real world and the real things, the real cycles that are happening. But yeah, I'd say like getting through community drama, appreciating it, appreciating the people that you work with, giving yourself a break, giving other people a break, like so often we hold ourselves to such high standards that when we get cranky, it's because we feel like we're not doing a good enough job. And it's like, no, you are. Like, and someday, some weeks will be harder and some months will be harder and you might be in a funk, but like be really nice to yourself, and also realize that for the most part, like no one's out to get you. Like for the most part, people do want to see others succeed. And so surround yourself with people that want to see you succeed and that have your back when you're having a hard time. And that goes with professional relationships too. You don't have to be like super buddy buddy with someone to feel comfortable calling up a different nonprofit doing something else or a different business doing something else, and talking to people on a human to human level. That's really good, even if you're not going to be like besties, but just seeking inspiration from what people are doing.
What advice would you give to other women that are starting their career in your field and trying to do environmental work?
Kind of what I was mentioning before, but I think especially for women, having that network and reaching out, going beyond your comfort zone to connect with people. I mean, it is comical, the amount of weird misogyny in every facet. In the plant world, it cracks me up. I had a professor from a university far, very far away from here, east, on the east side of the country, who bought some seeds for us for a project, and who then called because he didn't know how to germinate them. And so I was explaining to him, like, we have information on our website to for how to germinate seed. But then he kept like interrupting me constantly to like tell me what the correct words were to use that I should be using. And it was cracking me up because I was like, dude, you're calling me because you don't know how to grow this, which is totally okay. And I'm down to talk with you for as long as it takes to make sure you feel comfortable. But his communication was so funny. And I was also like, oh my gosh, you're in a leadership position where you're supposed to be encouraging people. And he was obviously scared and really insecure and had a lot going on. Yeah, so often that gets put on, like you're more comfortable showing that insecurity when maybe you're intimidated by a woman. But I'd say for women trying to do this work, like connect with other people and keep trying. Like even if someone's rude or busy or having a hard time, like keep trying. I just had a really great conversation with someone who was in our class, who I won't mention by name, but who was in the virtual class and who reached out and was like at the beginning of her professional career and just wanted a lot of advice of what other organizations in her region she could reach out to. And I gave her a short list, and she gave me names of places that I didn't even know were starting up. And that's always helpful because when we get so focused in our own work, we often really narrow and aren't looking at a lot of other projects. So that connection, it's so scary to do, but to realize that like everyone always has imposter syndrome. I think oftentimes women are much harder on themselves. Seek that community and seek those mentorship opportunities, even if they're not structured, but like that reaching out, or needing a specific question or needing a specific introduction. Because that is what it takes. It's like none of us can do it alone, you know, ever. Like I've had so much support from a variety of people, and even people I don't even know very well, but like really motivate me and that I'm really inspired by, you know, like those, like we're not even besties. Sometimes it's maybe better to not get too close with people, or then you're like see all the difficult stuff. But when if you can keep someone on a pedestal. Like my agave hero is like Wendy Hodgson. Oh my gosh. Having like someone that I've met a handful of times, every time I see her, she's kind and supportive, and I don't even know her very well, but I think the world of her. And people like that in my journey have meant so much to me. I encourage that for women. And it is hard. It's not like that's super easy to do, but I encourage you to do it. Go out and talk to people.
Yeah, I feel like I somehow a couple of years ago I started like encouraging myself to get out of this my comfort zone because I wasn't feeling very comfortable enough. So, but this is very scary and talking with someone that you don't know and start like looking for those connections that in instantly we feel like, what am I doing? I'm just making a fool of myself. But then later you start appreciating these connections and people start talking to you and it's a start. So
Oh
these are
yeah.
great advice.
Yeah, and it and like no one is thinking about you as much as you are, right? And if you do encounter someone who's a jerk, like that's their problem because I mean, I don't know anyone that I respect that even like I don't know, when we're talking about someone that we just met that's ever like this idiot walked in and had a question about like no one ever says that. It's always really nice to connect with people.
It's only in your own head, like,
Yeah.
oh, this person was thinking about me like this way, but it's only in your head. It's not
Yeah.
reality.
And then sometimes like those people might have extreme anxiety and it's really hard for them to connect, and so they seem rude, but they have other stuff going on and you don't even know. So just like it's rarely your thing. Gleason, you've done a great job of connecting. I feel like in the plant world, you've done such a good job. I love that you're growing plants, and it takes a lot.
Thank you, Francesca. Yeah, I guess I don't know. I'm weird because I am very antisocial and quiet, but also I get bored being like that, and then I need to like do something different, and that's why I'm helping with this podcast and the plants and going out, and yeah, but I'm super weird. Sometimes I can be like that, sometimes I just hide in my cave with my bunnies and don't want to know anything about nothing. But yeah, I admire people like you that you're always also like doing all kinds of things. And
I want to encourage all Mujeres Fronterizas and anyone listening to learn a new native plant. Get excited about a plant in your life. And yeah, definitely follow. If you're in Southern Arizona, I mean, Southern Arizona is an incredible community with various amazing organizations and people and badass women doing great work. So I love that this podcast exists. Thank you so much for having me. And I can't wait for what your other interviews look like and all the exciting people you get to talk to. Good work, Christian.
so easy to talk with you, Francesca. I always
Oh.
appreciate our conversations. I just wanna say thank you. Thank you so much. Muchas gracias, Francesca. Thank you all for tuning in today's episode. We look forward to bringing more stories of women in conservation on the waterlands. A special thanks to Sky Island Alliance, Luis Mistal, Amy Amoroso, and Denise Moreno, which they are the ones that make this podcast happen. See you next time.